figure out the fastest way to factor.
Jen Bernstein, proving primality in polynomial time.
Factoring really big numbers, where most of the methods you can think of just are hopeless for really big numbers, so you can throw them away. If you have a small number like this, then there's a ton of methods that might be good. It turns out, actually, for a number of this size, with a couple of big prime factors that you don't easily see by trial division, one of the best ways to factor those numbers is CFRAC. In particular, there's a simplified form of CFRAC, which you heard about in the last lecture. So CFRAC, you heard, generates a bunch of numbers given D that you're trying to factor. There's D up there. Given D that you're trying to factor, you generate A's and B's and Q's such that AI squared is this minus 1 to the I plus 1 QI plus 1 mod D. And then if you can find a subset, non-empty subset of the Q's whose product is a square, then hopefully that'll give you, multiplying the A's correspondingly, hopefully you get a factorization of D because you have a congruence of squares. The simplified form, Schenck's square form factorization, streamlines that by first saying for small numbers, actually, one of the best things to do is just look for the QI plus 1 to be a square. Not even try to combine things. Just hope to get a square congruent to a square. And you can easily see that takes about 4 through to D time before that happens. And then he also streamlined, using infrastructure, which you heard about in the previous talk, streamlined the final computation of the AIs. Just did some computations with the QIs. Anyway, so that's the way that you should factor numbers of this size. There's lots more methods out there, and depending on exactly how big your numbers are, it's a really interesting challenge to try to factor small numbers. It's, again, a much more subtle problem than trying to factor big numbers where we can throw away most of the methods that we know. All right, so after factoring this number with Skoufoff simplification of CFRAC, I found here the two prime divisors of it, and then I'm done. I look at those numbers and I kept going a little while on the factorization, and it generated lots of squares, and each time it found, oh yeah, these are the two factors. And so I'm pretty confident there are no other factors. I looked at those numbers and I checked 2 to the power 317213509 mod to 317213509, and it came out to 2, which is a pretty good hint that the number is prime, and same for the other one, but that doesn't guarantee that it's prime. I've been saying through my whole description of factorization, well, we don't really need to prove what we're doing because you can always check at the end. You don't need to prove how fast your algorithms are because you can just try them and you see how fast they are. You don't need to prove that you've succeeded at your factorization because once you're done, you just look at your numbers and observe that they multiply out to be your original number. You don't have to prove anything except how do I know that I'm actually done? Again, I've just checked 2 to this power is 2, and that doesn't guarantee that that number 2 to the power n being congruent to 2 mod n does not guarantee that n is prime. You heard last week about some other primality testing, primality proving even methods, but those are methods that don't scale in a provable, guaranteed way. It's something where you don't get a short proof by any of the techniques that I understand you heard about last week. You don't get a short proof that a number is prime. Depending on how big it is. For a number of this size, well, you could check by trial division that it's prime, and that would not take very long for your computer, but you can hope for a faster proof. So a reasonable question to ask, which I've not satisfactorily answered in just talking about these factorization algorithms, is how do you prove that numbers are prime? In particular, let's prove that this number, this 317213509, is prime. Now, I'm going to show you the world's longest proof that this number is prime. This is a proof longer than any previous proof that this number is prime. You're supposed to be impressed by this. I'm going to then go back and look at what would happen if I tried to generalize the same proof to any number n. And you can try either figuring out while I'm doing that number or later on when I say the general case, you can prove for yourself that this other number is prime, therefore completing the proving that I've completed this factorization, guaranteeing, justifying your answer. You know, you do a factorization and then you write the answer on your test and teacher says, justify your answer. Well, okay, here is going to be the complete justification, at least for one of the primes, and I'll let you do the other prime. All right. I should emphasize again, today we're worried about proving everything, so everything I say is supposed to be justified mathematical fact. If there's anything that you don't believe, then please interrupt me and say, hey, why is that true? These are all supposed to be proofs that, with at most an undergraduate algebra course, you can verify. All right. First step in the proof, I claim this much smaller number, 3391, what does that have to do with anything? Hey, I'm not saying that I'm telling you where the proof is coming from. I'm just telling you this is a proof. I'm going to make true statements here, and I'll deduce at the end that that number is prime. First step is 3391 is prime. And this, well, 3391 is small enough that I can tolerate dividing it by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Actually, I'm going to farm this out. Could you please do dividing by 2 and 3, and you handle 4 and 5, and you handle 6 and 7, and we'll go around the room in the obvious way. And if anybody finds that any of these divide 3391, then please let me know. Okay, good. I'm glad you're done with that computation. So you leave this step in the proof. And this is far enough to verify by trial division primality because the next number, 59 squared, is bigger than 3391. And, well, if you had a composite number, 3391, it would have to have a prime divisor less than or equal to the square root. So you don't have to, that prime would be between 2 and 58. You don't have to go beyond 58. Okay. The number 3172135 09, I'm going to get very sick of saying repeatedly, so let me abbreviate that as n. This number n, I'm going to prove to you that it's prime. For the moment, preliminary step, I claim it is not divisible by any prime below 3364. What does 3364 have to do with anything? Hey, I don't have to justify where I got the proof from, I just have to make a bunch of true statements and then at the end deduce that n is prime. So, 3364, it's smaller than 3391, it's not the same number. Let me go ahead with the proof. N is not divisible by, I just tried dividing it by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay, I won't read the list, down to 3363, and certainly all the primes are included in there, so I know, have you all verified the, please partition these numbers among yourselves? Okay, so you checked that part of the proof. Maybe somebody has a computer and they're inspired to do this computation. Okay, let me give a name to the smallest prime divisor event, which I'm going to prove is, and at the moment I haven't proven that, but let me just call it P. We don't know what P is, and we haven't computed P yet in a provable way, but we have checked that P is not 2, 3, 5, 7, etc. It's at least 3364. And now, another way to say that a prime is bigger than 33, bigger than or equal to 3364, I guess a prime can't be equal to 3364. Anyway, saying that P is at least that big, another way to say that is that 1, 2, 3 through 3364 are all different, mod P. In other words, if you look at these polynomials in the polynomial ring, FP adjoined X, then those polynomials are all different, mod P. So in FP adjoined X, those polynomials are different. Which implies by unique factorization of polynomials that if you're given any product of powers of these x minus 1 through x minus 3364, which are distinct irreducible polynomials, distinct irreducible elements of this unique factorization domain, then you can determine the exponents. There's a unique factorization of this, this product of powers into the individual pieces, so you can deduce e1 and e2 and so on from that. All right. Next step. I claim that n is a primitive root modulo this little prime, 3391. If I look at the order of n, well, first of all, n is not divisible by 3391. And if I look at its order, if I compute the powers of n, I get 1 first at n to the 3390, mod 3391. That comes out to 1. And I check that by just, well, okay, you can. Again, partition the effort among yourselves to check that n mod 3391 is 2414, which is not 1. That's dividing 3172135 09 by 3391, and there's the remainder, 2414, which is not 1. And I then multiply by 2414 repeatedly, not bothering to try to save effort. There are lots of ways you could speed up the computations I've talked about, but hey, I didn't say I was going for the fastest proof. I said I was going for the longest proof. So, okay, here is powers of n, powers of 2414, modulo 3391, and none of them were equal to 1 until the 3390th power. So every non-zero number mod 3391 is a power of n, and is a primitive root mod 3391. Okay, most complicated step of the proof is I'm looking at the ring Z mod n adjoined x mod x to the 3391 minus 1. So this is polynomials in one variable x with integer coefficients modulo n, the slash n means take everything mod n reduced to between 0 and n minus 1, and then the second slash there is reduced polynomials mod x to the 3391 minus 1. Whenever you see an x to the 3391, replace it by 1. How do I check that in this ring, the statement is that x minus 1 to the n is x to the n minus 1? Which, hey, if n is prime, which I'm going to prove, then of course that's true by the freshman binomial theorem, Fermat's little theorem. But okay, we don't know it. The only way to prove it at this point is to check it. And actually, this is not too bad of a computation. Computing x minus 1 to the n, and here I have written out n, 317213509, computing that takes just a few squarings and multiplications. For instance, getting x minus 1 to the n, multiply x minus 1 by x minus 1 to the n minus 1, and this n minus 1 being even, you easily get from x minus 1 to the n minus 1 over 2. Just square that, and then multiply by x minus 1 again, and well, applying the same idea recursively, as you've heard, you do a square, multiply, and eventually, after just something like 30 multiplications total, you get up to x minus 1 to the n, where all the squarings and multiplications are done in this ring. All of the coefficients are reduced modulo 317213509. So x minus 1 squared, for instance, is x squared minus 2x, there's minus 2 mod n, plus 1, and then x minus 1 to the 4th, to the 8th, to the 9th, I forget exactly what the sequence of exponents is, after 30 or so squarings, you get to x minus 1 to the n, where notice that all of the powers of x there are at most 3390, because again, if you see it x to the 3391, change it to 1. If you see x to the 3392, change it to x, and so on. All right, so by repeatedly squaring, where most of these have 3391 coefficients, this dot, dot, dot is something x to the 3390, something x to the 3389, and so on and so on and so on, out to x to the 0, times some random looking numbers. Eventually, amazingly, when I get to x minus 1 to the n, I did the last multiplication by x minus 1 there and got x to the 2414 plus 317213508, which I recognize as 2414 is, I calculated before, n mod 3391. Is that still on the slide? Yeah, on the left there. N mod 3391 is 2414. And the plus n minus 1 there, that's the same as minus 1. X to the n mod 3391, that's the same as x to the n. X has order 3391. So x to the n is the same as x to the n mod 3391, in other words, x to the 2414. So x minus 1 to the n is just computed, exponentiate in this ring, and you see x to the n minus 1. So subject to a lot of calculation, I have proven that x minus 1 to the n is x to the n minus 1. And then I do the same with x minus 2. X minus 2 to the n is x to the n minus 2 in exactly the same ring. Modulo n, all the integer coefficients are taken modulo n, and all of the polynomials are taken modulo x to the 3391 is 1. And you can see the coefficients changing a bit. Oops, I actually miscopied there. That's a plus 4. X minus 2 squared is x squared minus 4x plus 4. Oops, the other numbers I took out of my computer, so I'm much more sure that those are right. Don't do calculations in your head. It's a bad idea. You get incorrect results. Here is the actual computer-verified result, that x minus 2 to the n is, in fact, x to the n minus 2 modulo n. All right. Sorry for that. And then I kept going a little while. I did x minus 3 to the n, x minus 4 to the n, x minus 5 to the n, x minus 6 to the n, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And oops, I'm off the bottom of the slide there. I kept going until x minus our buddy 3364 to the n. A lot of calculation, but hey, the computer just did it and verified that all these things are equal to all these other things. All these polynomials work out correctly. X minus 3364, I computed the nth power of that, and it was all exactly the same kind of just 30-something squarings and multiplications modulo n, and modulo x to the 3391 is 1, and once again got x minus 3364 to the n, x minus whatever, x minus a to the n is x to the n minus a. Modulo n modulo x to the 3391 is 1. All right, I stopped at that point with the exponentiations, decided that 1, 2, 3, all the way through 3364 was enough, and you might again wonder why. Well, first of all, why am I doing this instead of just trial division? Answer, hey, my proof, I make the rules. Why am I going up through 3364? My proof, I make the rules. Again, these are all true statements, which I'm sure you've all checked as we are going along. Let me do some statements that, after you've checked all those calculations, these are maybe a little more mathematical, a little more, well, concise anyway. Here are some calculations that you should find easier to verify and assuming that you've had your computer checking all the nasty stuff, this is stuff that you should be able to check in your head. Play with equations. Let me start from, I have these equations, x minus a to the n is x to the n minus a. Modulo n and modulo x to the 3391 minus 1. And certainly if those polynomials are the same mod n and mod x to the 3391 is 1, then they're also the same mod p, p being a divisor of n. So in the ring fp adjoint x mod x to the 3391 minus 1, we have x minus a to the n is, again, x to the n minus a. That's what the calculations, the exponentiations, have shown. And now into that equation, I'll substitute x to the n and x to the n squared and so on for x. What happens if I want x to the n minus a to the n? Instead of x minus a to the n, suppose I want x minus a to the n squared, which is from the third line there. X minus a to the n squared is x to the n minus a to the n. And I can figure that out by plugging x to the n into the same equation. If I take x minus a to the n equals x to the n minus a, and then plug in x to the n for x, what do I get? I get x to the n minus a to the n is x to the n squared minus a. Modulo, got to be a little bit careful here. When you substitute, you also have to substitute in the modulus. These polynomials are the same mod x to the 3391 minus 1. And if I plug in, so that means the difference between them is x to the 3391 minus 1 times something. And if I, in that equality, if I substitute x to the n for x, then I better do it in the modulus as well to get a true equation. So instead of having x to the n minus a to the n equals x to the n squared minus a in the original ring, I have it in the ring fp adjoint x mod x to the n to the 3391 minus 1. But that gives me an equation in the original ring because the modulus I want, x to the 3391 minus 1, divides x to the n to the 3391 minus 1. So same thing for every n to the I. You can substitute x to the n to the I into the original equation, x minus a to the n is x to the n minus a, and you get x to the n to the I minus a to the n is x to the n to the I plus 1 minus a, modulo x to the n to the I to the 3391 minus 1, which is a multiple of x to the 3391 minus 1, and therefore mod x to the 3391 minus 1, original modulus, we get all of these equations. Then by induction, I said, suppose you want x minus a to the n squared, or in general x minus a to the n to the I, you just repeatedly apply x to the n minus a to the n, for instance, is x to the n squared minus a, and in general, x minus a to the n to the I is x to the n to the I minus a, in this ring, fp adjoint x mod x to the 3391 minus 1. Now everything I've done here actually doesn't depend on reducing mod p. These are all true mod n, but the next thing I do is going to depend on p being prime. This is not just for any divisor p of n. I'm going to take p's powers, and those behave nicely since p is prime, by the Freshman binomial theorem, by Fermat's little theorem. If you take p's powers, or p to the j powers for any j, of this equation, x minus a to the n to the I, then you can just move the p's powers through plus and minus sign. So x minus a to the n to the I to the p to the j is x to the n to the I minus a, that was my equation on the previous slide, to the p to the j power, which is move the p to the j into the subtraction there, and you get x to the n to the I p to the j minus a to the p to the j. But a is just an integer. If you take its p-th power, it's the same as a. Again, Fermat's little theorem, modulo p. So in this coefficients mod p and polynomials mod x to the 3391 equals 1, we know that x minus a to a whole bunch of different powers is x to the whatever power minus a. And now I'm going to make one further definition of some quantity that I haven't proven anything about yet and haven't computed, but I can still reason about it. Namely, h is some irreducible, doesn't have to be the smallest, p also doesn't have to be the smallest, but just for concreteness, let's say the smallest in lexicographic order, the smallest irreducible divisor of the 3391st cyclotomic polynomial. The point of this h, the point of finding a prime dividing n and finding a polynomial prime, an irreducible dividing this quotient, is that if you now reduce mod p and mod h, you get a field. The same equations, well, you can certainly reduce an equation mod any divisor of the original modulus instead of x to the 3391 minus 1. That's divisible by h, so certainly this equation is still true modulo h. saying less information, and aha, this FP adjoint X mod H is a field. It's a field quotient of our original ring, Z mod N adjoint X mod X to the 3391 minus 1, where all the exponentiations were done. I'm going to want to know that these X minus A's are non-zero and in this field, that they're not divisible by H. They're units in this field. And just to save a little bit of work later, and let me do a little bit of work for that now. Certainly, H being a divisor of X to the 3391 minus 1 by construction implies that X to the 3391 is congruence 1 mod H. In other words, the order of X in this field is some divisor of 3391, positive divisor, and, well, 3391 we know is prime. So the only possible orders are 1 or 3391. And 1 is not possible. Suppose that X had order 1. Suppose X is congruent to 1. X to the 1 is congruent to 1 mod H. Then, well, okay, H divides X minus 1 in the polynomial ring, FP adjoint X. But H also divides X to the 3391 minus 1 divided by X minus 1. So multiplying those divisibilities, we get H squared divides X to the 3391 minus 1. However, I claim there are no squared divisors, irreducible squared divisors, certainly one squared divides, but no irreducible squared, no prime squared, if you like, divides X to the 3391 minus 1 in this ring FP adjoint X. The reason for that is that 3391 is non-zero in FP, and there's this general test that you should know from algebra of how do you check if a polynomial is square-free. If you have H squared, if you have X to the 3391 is minus 1 is h squared times something, then taking derivatives, you see that h divides both x to the 3391 minus 1 and its derivative. And what's the derivative of x to the 3391 minus 1? It's 3391 x to the 3390. And if h divides that, then, hey, wait a minute, we can see all the irreducible factors of that. It's just x is the only irreducible factor. So h would have to be x, but it also divides x minus 1, and that's not possible. So because 3391, I'm implicitly using here that that derivative is non-zero, and, well, I made it explicit on the slide, otherwise the derivative would be non-zero, the square freeness argument would break down. If p were equal to 3391, then x to the 3391 minus 1 would have x minus 1 as a squared factor. In fact, if p were equal to 3391, then x to the 3391 minus 1 would be x minus 1 to the power of 3391, nowhere near square free. But p cannot be equal to 3391 because we checked 3391 does not divide n. N mod 3391 was not 0, it was 2414. So, okay, we know that p is not a divisor, not equal to this other prime 3391, and therefore x to the 3391 minus 1 has no squared factors, h squared does not divide it, and therefore x does not have order 1 in this field. It has order 3391 in this field. That tells us that x to the n is not equal to x. If x to the n were equal to x, that would mean that n minus 1, the difference of exponents, is a multiple of the order of x. N minus 1 would be a multiple of 3391, and that's not true. Again, n mod 3391 is not 1, it's not 0, it's 2414. So, x to the n is not equal to x, and therefore, x to the n minus a is not equal to x minus a, but x to the n minus a, we know, is x minus a to the n. For all the a's between 1 and 3364. Therefore, x minus a is non-zero. If it were 0, then its nth power would be equal to itself. Okay, so all these x minus a's that I've been working with are non-zero in the field FP adjoint x mod h. And now I'll multiply them together. For any subset of the a's, for any t being a subset of 1 through 3364, let me define pi sub t as a product of the x minus a's, where a runs over t. For instance, pi sub 6 comma 9 is x minus 6 times x minus 9. And same for any subset of 1 through 3364. Pi sub empty set is the polynomial 1. Pi sub 1, 2, 3 is x minus 1 times x minus 2 times x minus 3 in the ring FP adjoint x. But then I'm about to reduce the pi t's modulo h. Before I do that, let me observe that the maximum possible degree of pi t is, well, multiplying all the x minus 1, x minus 2 through x minus 3364, which would have degree 3364 in the polynomial ring, FP adjoint x. The maximum degree of pi t is 3364. I'll come back to that. Taking the x minus a equations that I know and putting them together, I get equations for all these products. What happens if I take the n to the I, p to the j power of pi sub t? For any of these products, well, for instance, the x minus 6, x minus 9 to the np power. Well, taking the definition of pi t, it's a product of x minus a's. Compute the n to the I, p to the j power of that, and I know that x minus a to the n to the I, p to the j is the same as x to the n to the I, p to the j minus a. In other words, if I compute the n to the I, p to the j power, I get, look at this, this is the same pi t evaluated at x to the n to the I, p to the j. All these equations are modulo h because, well, okay, the last two is true in the polynomials without mod h, the first two, those are equal, not mod h, but the middle here, this is mod h. That's where we know that x minus a to some np or n squared p cubed to whatever power is x to the same power minus a. Multiplying these, we get a power of pi t is pi t evaluated at that power of x, modulo h. This is the critical equation that will eventually allow us to prove that n is prime. We're actually getting pretty close at this point. I need a little bit more algebraic work here that these pi's, I claim, are all different in the field fp adjoint x mod h. I claim that if pi t equals pi u modulo h, if those polynomials like x minus 6 times x minus 9, if that's the same as x minus 1, x minus 2 modulo h, then actually that can't happen unless you have the same set. Pi t equals pi u, I'm going to get at the bottom here that t equals u. How does the logic work there? Well, if pi t equals pi u mod h, if they're congruent mod h, then I can compute their np or whatever n to the I, p to the j power, and those are still congruent mod h. And now applying the critical equation, I see that pi t evaluated at x to the n to the I, p to the j, which is the same as the n to the I, p to the j power of pi t, that's the same as pi u to that power, which is, working backwards, pi u evaluated at x to the n to the I, p to the j. Those are congruent modulo h. And therefore, the polynomial pi t minus pi u has x to the n to the I, p to the j as a root. If you evaluate it at x to the n to the I, p to the j, you get exactly the difference between the two quantities I just said are equal modulo h. In this field, we've just identified a whole bunch of roots of pi t minus pi u, namely all of the x to the n to the I, p to the j's, in particular, all the x to the n to the i's. Remember that n to the I covers all the possibilities for numbers mod 3391. So we have x and x squared and x cubed and all the way up to x to the 3390. All of those are roots, and they're distinct roots because x has order 3391, as I said before. All of those are different roots of pi t minus pi u in this field. And now you know from algebra that a polynomial with 3390 different roots in a field has to be degree at least 3390, has to be divisible by the product of x minus each of those roots. But that's not true. Pi t minus pi u has degree at most 3364. Contradiction, unless this polynomial is zero. That's the only polynomial small degree that can have a whole bunch of different roots. Pi t minus pi u has to be zero. Pi t equals pi u. And as I said before, we have unique factorization into x minus 1, x minus 2, and so on through x minus 3364, because we know p is bigger than 3364, and therefore t equals u. Okay. We've identified at this point a whole bunch of different pi sub t's. There are 2 to the power 3,364 subsets t of 1 through 3364. Those of you who were bored with the proof, start making a list of all the t's and checking that the pi t's are all different. Well, okay, no, you can't do that because you don't know what p and h are at this point. Okay, we're almost done with the proof here. There are a whole bunch of different subsets t, and each one of them gives a different pi t. That's what I just proved, is that pi is an injective function from subsets to elements of this field. All the pi t's are different, modulo h. There are 2 to the 3364 different pi's, all of which satisfy that critical equation that I'm going to apply to some particular exponents, which I'm identifying here. Suppose you restrict I and j to just be between 0 and 58. Then n to the I, p to the j is, well, first of all, it's a positive integer. It's at least 1. And how big could it possibly be? Well, p is some divisor of n. It's at most n. N to the I, n to the j. It's at most n to the 58, n to the 58. N is less than or equal to 2 to the 29. If you look at N, it was 317-213-509 or something like that, which is less than half a billion, and therefore less than 2 to the 29. In general, maybe I should say a little bit at this point about where some of the numbers came from. If you calculate this 2 to the 29 to the 58 plus 58, you get that 3364 is 58 plus 58 times 29. That's the source of the 3364, actually. That came from the square, well, 4 times, taking account of the 2 times 29 and another 2 times 29. 3364 is 4 times the square of this log base 2 of n. Well, rounding n up to a power of 2, 2 to the 29, I take that 29, square it, multiply by 4. That's where the 3364 came from. The 3391 was something bigger. I'll come back to what properties we wanted out of the 3391 in just a couple slides. The number of these pairs I and j is, now that I've got a bound on how big these n to the i, p to the j's are, the number of these pairs I and j is, well, 59 possibilities for I, 59 possibilities for j. There's more than 3391 pairs I, comma j. Therefore, by the pigeonhole principle, if we reduce all of the n to the i, p to the j's mod 3391, we have to get a collision. Now let me pause for a moment and say, what would happen if n is not p and not p squared and not any power of p? Then these n to the i, p to the j's all have to be different. Because if n has some other prime divisor aside from p, then if you look at n to the i, p to the j, you can figure out the power of that. You can figure out I from looking at the power of that other prime, and then dividing out n to the i, you can figure out j is what j is. If you know n and p, then you can figure out I and j. If n is not a power of p, then all of these n to the i, p to the j's are different. But there are collisions in the mod 3391 for some small inputs, I, j, k, and l, between 0 and 58. There have to be some different pairs, I, j, and k, l, such that n to the I, p to the j, and n to the k, p to the l, have the same remainder mod 3391. Note that the difference between these powers is at most 2 to the 3364 minus 1, because they're all between 2 to the 3364 and 1. Those of you who have been counting slides, you know where we are at this point. Yeah, remember the critical equation. I'm going to apply the critical equation to the n to the i, p to the j, and n to the k, p to the l for all the pi t's. It's funny how an example, just a particular n, can lead us to, there's no numbers left on this slide, maybe the 3364 there, but okay. We know that mod h, we have any of those products, pi t, to the n to the i, p to the j power, are the same as pi t evaluated at x to the n to the i, p to the j. Now, why am I looking at these n to the i, p to the j's mod 3391? That's because I care about x to the n to the i, p to the j. That's what's been showing up through the whole previous proof, and that x has order 3391, so x to the n to the i, p to the j is the same as x to the n to the k, p to the l. So pi t evaluated at x to the n to the i, p to the j is just equal to, well, all this is in the field mod h, it's equal to pi t evaluated at x to the n to the k, p to the l, which by the critical equation in reverse is the n to the k, p to the l power of pi t. Remember, pi t is non-zero. All the x minus a's were non-zero in this field, so pi t is a unit, and then we can divide the left side by the right side, get pi t is an n to the i, p to the j, minus n to the k, p to the l, root of 1. So, how many of these roots of 1 are there? We've just identified 2 to the 3364 different roots of 1, where the exponent in those roots is a number that's less than 2 to the 3364. The exponent there, pi t to this power, this exponent is at most 2 to the 3364 minus 1. But there are more than 2 to the 3364 minus 1 pi t's. There are at least 2 to the 3364, well, exactly that many of the pi t's. And there's no way you can have that. Inside a field, Fp adjoint x mod h, you cannot have this many, more than this many roots of 1. I mean, if you're looking for, say, fifth roots of 1, or 3391st roots of 1, there's at most 3391 of them. The only way that this can work out, the only way we can avoid the contradiction, is if that exponent is 0. And then you can have more than 0 roots of pi to the 0 equals 1. Everything satisfies pi to the 0 is 1. So, the only way out of this contradiction, that there's more pi t's than the exponent, is for the exponent to be 0. N to the I, p to the j has to be equal to n to the k, p to the l. But that's what we just worked out, that if n is not a power of p, then we can't have n to the ip to the j being equal to n to the kp to the l. The way I wrote it here is they are equal, and if I were equal to k, then you could get rid of the n to the I into the k, conclude that j is equal to l, but wait, those pairs ij and kl are supposed to be different. So I has to be different from k, and that means that dividing through, we get n to the something equals p to the something, and that implies n is a power of p by unique factorization into integer prime. All right, and then going from n is a power of p to n is equal to p, well, you just check is n a square or cube, et cetera. You've heard about perfect power detection last week, I believe, and that's an easy computation to do. So we've proven that n is equal to p. P is prime, therefore n is prime. All right. I want to review what happens in the same proof if n is any number. For instance, the other prime factor of 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, et cetera. And you can apply this to any number n. And what's amazing about it is that actually this proof, as n gets bigger and bigger, the proof does not get much harder. It seems pretty painful so far. Well, okay, maybe the logic part of it is not so bad, but all the computations you have to do, all the computations you have to check, those clearly take more time than trial division. However, as n gets bigger and bigger, trial division gets slower quite rapidly. It's exponential time. It takes time square root of n to verify that n is prime. And this proof of primality takes much less time. This takes only, in fact, polynomial time in the number of digits of n. It's log n to the big O of 1. I'll be more precise about what the big O of 1 is later on. This proof does not require any randomness. Well, you might think, hey, where's that random number 3391 coming from? I'll explain how you can deterministically decide what that 3391 is. There's no conjectures. Both in the proof of primality, that's not relying on any conjectures, not relying on any computations beyond what you do here. There's no pre-computation required, as in, say, pseudo-squares primality proofs. There's no Riemann hypothesis required. This is just an absolute proof of primality of n. And the proof that it runs in polynomial time is something that doesn't require any conjectures. This is something where, while analyzing n being prime, you can also analyze the amount of time you've taken to prove that n is prime, and prove, without much effort, that that's, at most, this log n to the big O of 1. So there's no conjectures running around at all. We have a satisfactory proof, not just for this number n, but for any number n, we can guarantee there's this reasonably short, reasonably fast proof that n is prime. Again, for such a small number, don't do this proof. Do trial division, which by the time you finish verifying all the computations I was talking about, certainly you could have done trial division much more easily. But trial division scales much worse than this proof does. And I could write down much larger n's where we could prove primality in this way, and you would never be able to complete it with trial division. There's one part of the proof that gets more complicated when you generalize from a single n that you try out to trying to prove that the algorithm works well. Stating an algorithm and proving it takes polynomial time for every n takes time at most some power of log n. There's one difficulty there, which is, okay, what is the q? The 3391 is going to generalize to q. And it would be really nice to know that n is a primitive root modulo some q that's a little bigger than the 3364, a little bigger than 4 times ceiling of log n squared, but not much bigger, say, at most 8 times log n squared. It would be nice to know there's some constant you can stick in there. In fact, it would be nice to know there's any reasonable power you can stick in there, log n to the fifth. It would be nice to be able to prove that n is a primitive root mod some prime q between this log n squared and log n to the 100th, but we can't prove that. We don't know how to prove that there are lots of q's in this range, or any q's in this range, where n is a primitive root. So we complicate the proof a little bit. Instead of relying on n being a primitive root mod some q, which if you try it out, you always easily find a q where n is a primitive root, some prime q a little bigger than the 3364, a little bigger than 4 log n squared, ceiling with log n squared, you find a q easily where n is a primitive root. But we don't know how to prove that. So to get a completely satisfactory algorithm where we can not just prove primality, but we can prove that we can quickly prove primality, in order to do that, we allow q to be a little more flexible, a lot more flexible. We throw away primitive roots, and that means we have to do a little more work in the algebraic part of the proof. What exactly are the requirements on q? Well, what we do is we insist that n have reasonably large order, not necessarily be a primitive root. Depending how big q is, this is maybe not requiring that n be a primitive root. We just require it have order bigger than 3364, or in general, the square of 2 times the ceiling of log n. And, well, if Q is not much bigger than that, this is enough to guarantee n is a primitive root. But if Q is much bigger, then maybe n is not a primitive root. We define Q. Here is the start of the general algorithm, and it's the complications are basically here and one later algebraic step. You find the first prime number Q that does not divide n minus 1. That's saying that n is not 1 mod Q, so n has order bigger than 1 mod Q. And Q does not divide n squared minus 1. That's saying that Q does not divide, well, n squared minus 1, that's saying n does not have order 2 modulo Q, and so on through. You can think of various ways to reduce this product, but you keep going through n to the whatever power you want to guarantee that the order of n is bigger than that. So here's, okay, well, I don't have to prove anything at this point. Here's a quantity that you can write down, n to some maybe kind of painful power, but you can still compute this number and find the smallest prime number Q that is not divided by just enumerating all the possible prime numbers. So you run through primes P, 2, 3, 5, etc. Well, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Check primality. Actually, you've heard already last week about much faster ways to enumerate primes, but we don't really need to worry about the speed here. I'll get back to that in a moment. You look for each P, once you know it's prime, you check n to the 1, n to the 2, well, you check n mod P, and then check n to the 1, n to the 2, and so on, all the way through n to the 3364, or whatever that number is, mod P, see if any of those are equal to 1. And if any of them are, if n is 0 mod P, or any of those n to the something are 1 mod P, then you go back to the, and try, go back to the top of the loop, try the next P. This does not take very long because your final P, your Q, the smallest Q that does not divide this number, is tiny compared to n. When n gets really big, experimentally, conjecturally, we see that Q is about the square of log n. So even if n has billions of digits, Q is something you can just count up to Q. Well, okay, all we can prove is that Q is at most the fifth power of log n. But even with that size of Q, you can count up to Q, depending how big n is, of course. This is much smaller than n. The time that it takes to count up to Q is polynomial in the log of n. The time it takes to check primality in any silly way is polynomial in Q. If you spent time P, which is at most time Q, on checking primality, then that's still some power of log n. If you inspect powers in some naive way, then it's still a power of log n for your total time. Now, why is Q at most the fifth power of log n? How do you prove that? Well, that's actually quite straightforward. Actually, when the original proof that primes is in P, that you can detect primality in deterministic polynomial time, when Agrawal and Kayal and Saxena published that in 2002, they were relying on quite a lot of analytic number theory. They had different conditions on Q which were harder to achieve. They needed to rely on Fouvre's theorem, which in turn relied on the Bombieri-Vinogradov theorem, some serious analytic number theory to prove that there was an appropriate Q matching their conditions. And then people started simplifying the proof, and the most important step was from Hendrik Lenstra observing that with considerably more algebra, you could really reduce the requirements on Q. Not quite as far as what I've said, but you could significantly reduce the requirements on Q and just rely on the prime number theorem. Just rely on a rough knowledge of how many primes there are up to K in order to find that the necessary Q existed. In fact, further simplifications, most importantly by somebody named Mackay, who I don't think has been mentioned before, Mackay observed a very nice simplification in the algebra that allows the Q to be it allows us to prove that Q exists really, really easily. Certainly, if you have the prime number theorem stated as, for example, the product of the primes less than or equal to k is about e to the k, e being the base of natural logarithms. If you have the prime number theorem, that's enough to show that Q is bounded by a polynomial in log n. In fact, you just need that the product of p's up through k is some exponential. If I have a little time left at the end, maybe I'll prove for you, first taste of analytic number theory beyond what you've seen in some previous talks, that the product of p is less than or equal to k is bigger than about 2 to the k. And any base there to the k is good enough for, in fact, any base to the square root of k would be enough for polynomial time down here. If you believe this exponential result, this is all the analytic number theory I'm going to need, then what does that tell you if k is some multiple of log n to the fifth? Well, let's take a concrete bound here. Say product of primes less than or equal to k is bigger than 2 to the k. Suppose that all the primes up to log n to the fifth divided this number. Suppose you didn't find a cube up to log n to the fifth. That means all the primes up to log n to the fifth divide this number, and therefore their product divides this number, but we know the product is big. We know the product is at least 2 to the k. And if k is log n to the fifth, or depending what the base of the exponential is, some constant times log n to the fifth, then 2 to the k is bigger than this number, just because looking at this number, how big is it? We're multiplying log n squared for log n squared numbers, each of which has at most log n cubed bits. The last number here, the biggest one, is n to the log n squared. That's something like 2 to the log n cubed. And so overall, it's about 2 to the log n to the fifth, maybe 2 to the 16 log n to the fifth. You can make some concrete number there that, okay, this quantity is at most 2 to the 16 log n to the fifth. And therefore, if k is bigger than 16 log n to the fifth, this product is bigger than 2 to the k, so it's bigger than loss and cannot have all of those p's dividing this number. There must be some q less than 16 log n to the fifth, such that q does not divide this number, and therefore n has big order modulo q. All right, replacement. There's actually a separation in the proof between the 3364 in general splits into a couple of numbers. One of them is the 2 times the ceiling of log n squared, and another one is 2 times the ceiling of log n times the floor of square root of q minus 1. If you calculate this for any particular example of n, then you see this, that's the same as the 3364, or, well, it's the same as 2 times ceiling of log n times another 2 times ceiling of log n. But the floor of the square root of q minus 1 turns out to be equal to 2 times the ceiling of log n. But we can't prove that q is that small. Beta here could be bigger, because q could be bigger. And, well, okay, here's the general definition to proceed with the proof. Define beta to be the 2 times the ceiling of log n to the power of the floor of square root of q minus 1. When you look at that, you should be thinking, that's a log of something. It's a log of n squared to the power of square root. And before, we had some n squared to the 58th. And the same thing happens in general. We believe that beta is log n squared, roughly. We prove this is just restating the bounds on q, which unfortunately I've gotten rid of at this point. But you remember that q is at most log n to the fifth. That tells you beta is at most log n to the 3.5 with some constant factor in front. Continuing the algorithm, once you've computed this beta, which is, just look at power of 2 bigger than n to see log n, and look at squares up to q to see the square root of q minus 1. You enumerate the primes less than beta. Actually, that's already done as part of enumerating the primes up through whatever q we found. And then if n equals one of those primes, then okay. N is so tiny, this can't happen, actually. Once n is reasonably large, then n is bigger than beta. So this can't happen. But if it did, to make an algorithm that works even for tiny n's, if n were equal to a prime less than beta, then we know that n is prime. Done. The algorithm says, yes, n is prime, and I've proven it by enumerating the primes. And if n is small enough, that's a perfectly reasonable way to do it. If n is divisible by a prime less than beta, and it's bigger than that prime, then you know n is composite. And that's also easy to prove. The algorithm can just say, okay, look, here's the divisor of n. From now on in the proof, let me assume n is not equal to, or more generally, divisible by any of those primes less than beta. And then the proof proceeds very much as before. You write down, at least conceptually, can't compute it, but you think about the smallest prime divisor p of n, and you've just checked n's not divisible by any prime less than beta, so p has to be at least beta. In other words, the polynomials x minus 1 through x minus beta, think of 3364 again, those polynomials are all different mod p, and therefore, by unique factorization, any product of powers of those determines the exponents. Any product of a subset of those determines the subset in particular. The algebraic complication, what you have to do, there's no analogous part of this. For any particular n, you don't have to think about this set G. But in general, to continue the proof, you have to write down a set G conceptually. Again, the algorithm doesn't compute this. We don't know what P is. And if you're given an n, you can go through this. This is part of the proof that n is prime. It's not part of the computation. You define G to be the set of products of powers of n and p, n to the I, p to the j, where I and j are non-negative. In every case you look at, n is a primitive root modulo q, and so those n to the i's mod q, even without the p to the j's, cover everything from 1 through q minus 1. The set G is just 1 through q minus 1, but in general you have to deal with G being smaller than that. And gamma here is maybe smaller than beta. Gamma is defined as 2 times the ceiling of log n times the floor square root of the size of g, number of elements of g. Take the square root of that, round down, multiplied by the log base 2 of n, rounded up, multiplied by 2, and okay, here I've taken 2 to this power, which you should always be thinking when you see logs, n to the power of 2 times the floor, square root of size of g, that is less than or equal to 2 to the gamma. The only difference between the sides, if you take logs, you see on the left there's a log n, and on the right there's a ceiling of log n. So okay, the left is less than or equal to the right. Also, we know that gamma is less than or equal to beta. Again, you do a practical computation, they're both the same, they're both 3364, or whatever particular number, 2 times the ceiling of log n. But in general, all we know is the size of g is at most q minus 1, so gamma is at most beta. We also know that g is not too small. It has to be at least 3364. Well, it includes all the powers of n, which by construction of q, we know there's a whole lot of different powers of n modulo q. We know that the number of elements of this group mod q is at least the order of n, which is greater than 4 times the ceiling of log n squared. Turning that around into a formula for gamma there, which is, again, typically 3364, well, in general, you can prove, just looking at these inequalities, that gamma, practically by definition, is less than or equal to this quantity, which I claim is less than the size of g, and that just comes from the previous equation, taking square roots and dividing out the square root here. You see that gamma is less than the size of g. Think of that as 3364 is less than 3390. This is the appropriate generalization of that for arbitrary numbers. Then you do a big computation. Well, it's very big, but it scales well. As n gets bigger and bigger, it doesn't get much bigger. It still remains a doable computation. For every a from 1 through 3364, well, 1 through beta in general, you compute the nth power of x minus a, and you compare it to x to the n minus a, modulo n, and modulo x to the q minus 1. That's a polynomial time computation. It's the biggest part of the computation in this type of primality proof. The total time for those exponentiations, let's count it. There's beta different a's to look at. That accounts for a beta in the runtime. There's, for each of the a's, there's an nth power to compute. That accounts for a log n in the runtime. And wait a minute, I've got another log n and a q, and that comes from the size of numbers in that ring, polynomials in that ring. If you have a polynomial, it's a polynomial with coefficients mod n, each of those having log n bits. Computed mod x to the q minus 1 still allows polynomial degrees up to q minus 1. So there's q coefficients in each polynomial times log n bits for each coefficient. That's q log n bits. And then the time to do multiplication of a q log n bit polynomial and do divisions by n and so on, that is essentially linear in q log n. There's a q log n here for the size of the ring. There's a log n for the nth powering, which you know is the logarithmic number of square roots and multiplications. And there's a beta for the number of a's. So that's the total number of bit operations. If you take the conjecture for how big q is, in practice, you always see q is about 4 log n squared, and then beta is also on that scale, well, almost exactly equal. And so beta times q times log n squared is about log n to the 6th. We can't prove that, but we can prove q is at most log n to the 5th, beta is at most log n to the 3.5. Putting all that together, I think I've correctly calculated log n to the 10.5. If you want the simplest possible proof, don't rely on fast Fourier transform multiplication. Change the 1 there to a 2, and you end up with log n to the 16.5 plus something. Or if you like, the total time is, for sufficiently large n, less than the 17th power of log n. That is a polynomial time computation, although if you plug in n being a million or so and think of 20 to the power of 16.5, that's starting to get pretty big. This might not seem like it's polynomial time. If you scale n, it doesn't seem to scale very well. This is quite a lot better. If you make n twice as many digits, which would make trial division inconceivably slower than it was, this just slows down by a factor of 2 to the 6th. Just 64 times more work for this proof. Okay, so that's the bottleneck in the computation. And if you find that x minus a to the n is not equal to x to the n minus a, you know that n is not prime. You've proven, you can just tell somebody, here's the a, compute for yourself x minus a to the n. Oh, also tell them the q, compute x minus a to the n minus x to the n plus a, modulo x to the q minus 1. They can do the exponentiation and verify for themselves. You just print out this proof, you print out all the computations you do and see that n is composite. Because if n were prime, these would have to be equal. So let's assume that, in fact, n does satisfy these equations for every a between 1 and beta, and then goes through the same manipulation, playing with the equations. I've compressed several slides down to one slide here. You go through all the n to the i substitutions and p to the j powerings with Fermat's little theorem, and you see that x minus a to the n to the I p to the j is x to the n to the I p to the j minus a modulo p and modulo x to the q minus 1, where p is a divisor of n. This is for every a between 1 and beta. It's for every non-negative integer I, every non-negative integer j, as before. And then reduce that equation modulo h, where h is some divisor of the qth cyclotomic polynomial. As before, take a preliminary division by x minus 1, and then find some, say, the smallest irreducible factor of that. Conceptually, again, you don't compute p, you don't compute h. You eventually end up proving that p is equal to n, but all right, here's a specific definition of an irreducible polynomial h, so that if we mod out by it, we get a field. And it has the wonderful property that x has order q modulo h, proven exactly the same way as before. We get the same equations, x minus a to the n to the I p to the j is x to the n to the I p to the j minus a for every a between 1 and beta. And actually, I think later on we'll just need 1 through gamma. Gamma's at most beta. There's a bunch of inequalities which you have to juggle to get to the end of the proof, and I'll just say at certain moments, here's some inequalities, here's the ones we're using, and that is something I wrote down before. The diagram of what implications there are in this proof is kind of convoluted, but okay. For the moment, 1 through beta, we're just manipulating these equations that you check as part of doing the proof. You get x minus a to the n to the I p to the j is congruent to x to the n to the I p to the j minus a mod p and mod h. The difference between those is p times something plus h times something. All right, again, x has order q, because you proved as before, it does not have order 1, and therefore x minus a, all the x minus a's are non-zero modulo h. And then I think I'm up to multiplying them together, just as before. Now we'll just take, 1 through gamma. You don't need all the way 1 through beta. One of the statements before, that the justification for choosing beta as large as it is for making it at least as big as the gamma, which plays the real role that 2 to the gamma is less than some, greater than n to some power. Okay, we know gamma is less than or equal to beta, so all of the equations we have for the x minus a's, where a goes up to beta, is also true if we just go up to gamma. We write down pi t's products just like before, x minus 5 times x minus 10, whatever. Each of those pi t's has degree at most gamma, because we're multiplying at most gamma of the x minus a's together. And now we get a critical equation, exactly the same manipulations as before. We know that x minus a to some power, to any n to the I p to the j power, is x to the same power minus a modulo h. And therefore, that same thing works for not just x minus a, but any product of the x minus a's. Any n to the I p to the j power of pi t is pi t evaluated at the same power of x. Modulo. Are there any differences on this slide? Perhaps not. Well, let me be a little careful with the inequalities. I claim that if pi t is equal to pi u, then t is equal to u. And the start of the proof is just like the specific example. You manipulate the critical equations and see, take powers of the pi t and pi u, same power. That's the same as evaluating pi t and pi u at some specific power of x, which is, well, any of these powers of x, there's lots of those, there's as many as the size of g of those, I'll come back to that. Each of the x to the n to the I p to the j's is a root of pi t minus pi u. If you evaluate that as before, at x to the n to the I p to the j, you get 0 modulo h. Therefore, pi t minus pi u has all of these x to the n to the I p to the j as roots. But remember, the definition of g was how many different n to the I p to the j's are there mod q. And x has order q. So the number of different roots here, the number of different x to the n to the I p to the j's is exactly, the number of roots we've written down is exactly the size of g. This polynomial has at least this many different roots in this field, and that's bigger than the degree. The degree is at most gamma, and one of the inequalities I had before was gamma is less than the size of g. That comes from the restriction on how big the order of n is modulo q. That turns into gamma is less than the size of g. The degrees of these polynomials, which is at most gamma, is less than the number of different x to the n to the ip to the j's in this field. And therefore, if the polynomial were non-zero, it couldn't possibly have this many roots. It has to be zero. Pi t minus pi u has to be zero. Pi t has to equal pi u. And therefore, unique factorization, coming from, we've checked by computation, that n has no factors less than gamma actually would be enough, but we don't know gamma. We've checked all the way up to beta, that n has no prime divisors there. That means all the x minus a's are different in the field fp adjoint x, and therefore these pi t, if pi t equals pi u in fp adjoint x, then t equals u. So we get from pi t being pi u modulo h to pi t being pi u not modulo h by the restriction on the degrees. That would be obvious if h had high degree. We can't prove that, but we can prove still that pi t equals pi u, and therefore t equals u. I started with all the t's, all the subsets of 1 through gamma, and as before, 1 through 3364. How many subsets are there? 2 to the gamma. The polynomials pi t are all different. That's what I just proved. So relying on all these inequalities about 3364 versus 3390, gamma versus size of g, okay, all of these 2 to the gamma polynomials pi t are different, modulo h. Now, if you look at n to the ip to the j, where I and j are up to 58, what happens in general? Well, you take the square root of the size of g. Take the greatest integer less than or equal to that, which, again, is something we don't know this number. We don't know p, we don't know g, but we can prove stuff about it anyway. If I and j are all the pairs between 0 and 58, or whatever that square root is generally, then each of the n to the ip to the j's, as before, is a positive integer, which we know is at most something convenient. P is at most n, I and j are at most the square root of the size of g, rounded down. So the products are at most n to the power of 2 times the floor of the square root of the size of g. And one of the inequalities I had before, which was coming from how do we come up with the 4 times ceiling of log n squared in the first place, that's to justify this n to this 2 times blah, n to the ip to the j's are all less than or equal to 2 to the gamma, which is guaranteeing that the differences between the n to the ip to the j and n to the kp to the l are at most 2 to the gamma minus 1, less than the number of different polynomials we've identified that are roots of something. Well, okay, continuing with the logic, the number of pairs I and j, the number of i's is bigger than the square root, because we started at 0. The number of j's is bigger than the square root, so multiplying those together, the total number of pairs is bigger than square root squared, which is the size of the group. What was the group? What is g? That was defined as the number of different n to the ip to the j's mod q. Therefore, if we take the n to the ip to the j's mod q for more than that number of pairs, there must be a collision. There have to be different pairs, exactly as before. There have to be different pairs I, j, k, l up to 58, or here's the general number, such that n to the ip to the j mod q is the same as n to the k p to the l mod q. In other words, such that x to the n to the ip to the j equals x to the n to the k p to the l in our field, modulo h. Last line here is emphasizing what I said about the sizes of these numbers. There are all these products we're looking at between 1 and 2 to the gamma. And the differences between those are at most 2 to the gamma minus 1. Concluding the same way as before, well, I have an extra slide to deal with the issues about prime powers and say a little bit more. But okay, basically, we're done at this point. If you look modulo h, critical equations, exactly like before, you take pi t to this particular n to the ip to the j power, and that's the same as pi t evaluated at x to the n to the ip to the j, which is equal in this field, it's equal modulo h to the n to the k p to the l power of x, and by the critical equation again, that's pi t to the n to the k p to the l. As before, we know pi t is a unit mod h, so we can divide the equation, get pi t to the power n to the ip to the j minus n to the k p to the l is 1. If that exponent were non-zero, then the number of, say it's 3391, then the number of roots, the number of pi satisfying pi to the 3391 is 1, would have to be at most 3391, because we're in a field. But, well, there are too many pi's. We've written down more pi's than the exponent. And the only way for that to be true, there's at least 2 to the gamma products pi and in this field, and there's at most, the exponent is at most 2 to the gamma minus 1 in absolute value. The only way for that to work is if the exponent is 0, if n to the I p to the j is equal to n to the k p to the l. This is this clever combinatorial trick that Agrawal and Kayal and Saxena came up with to prove that numbers are prime, is looking at all these differences, and well, they came up with most of the structure here, again, some pretty important simplifications, but this is basically AKS. Now that we know that the exponent n to the I p to the j minus n to the k p to the l is 0, you easily see that n is a power of p, exactly as before. All right, then we still don't know n is prime. We've just checked it's a power. Now, it would be awfully surprising if any power actually slipped through to this point. I mean, any non-trivial power, any square, cube, etc., actually got through to n satisfying all the equations. It's really unlikely for x minus 1 to the n to be x to the n minus 1 and all the other equations there if n is a power of a prime. In fact, I don't know if it could ever happen. It would be interesting to see computations establishing that, no, it doesn't happen up to some point, or, ooh, there's actually some n where it does happen, or maybe just x minus 1 to the n satisfies it's equal to x to the n minus 1 for n being a power of p. But, well, okay, haven't proven anything at this point, aside from we know n is a power of p, and now we resort to computation to say, as before, look at the square root of n, look at the cube root of n. Well, again, I think you've heard more about power testing last week. That's an easy computation. Just writing down a few numbers. There's lots of ways to check if n is a perfect power that run in polynomial time. And if we find that n is, in fact, a square, then we're awfully surprised, and we say, OK, n is composite. Look, it's the square of the following number. And by the way, you found a really interesting number. And so on for cube, and so on, up through the log of n, log base 2 of n. If n is not a square, cube, etc., then we know n is a power of p, but not a perfect power, not a square, and so on. So it must be prime. This proof has either told us that n is prime, or it's told us that n is composite. If n was composite, then, okay, we can't get to this point, because at this point we've proven it's prime. So the algorithm must have terminated at some point. If n was composite, we go through the computations, and one of those must tell us, yes, n is composite. And here actually is a pretty short proof of it. Or if n is prime, then we've proven that. If the endpoint is a prime, then we've written down a reasonably short proof that n is prime. The total size of the proof is, well, here I've repeated what I said about the bottleneck, the total length of the proof is polynomial in n, and if you work out what that polynomial is, reasonable conjectures for how big q is, namely log n squared, the size of q is log n squared, and this was the total time for the exponentiations, as before the theorem for how long the algorithm takes, how long the proof is this 10.5 power of log n. The easiest theorem to prove, if you throw away fast multiplication to try to minimize the length of the proof, then you get the 16.5 power of log n. Actually, I think you can even get rid of the plus little o of 1 here without serious effort, but anyways. At most, some constant power of log n, and the definition of primes is in P, is that the set of binary expansions of prime numbers can be recognized by a polynomial time algorithm, an algorithm whose time is at most some constant power of the length of the input, length being that log n, and 16.5 being a constant. If you don't like the 16.5, you can reduce it to 10.5, and then we believe, if we actually try the algorithm, the practical performance is 6. But if you want the fastest proof of this theorem, then throw away fast arithmetic, and you get a 16.5 exponent. Okay. I still have a few minutes, amazingly, so let me prove the prime number theorem for you. Well, okay, that's a little bit nasty to do. Let me prove that the product of primes is at least exponential. I'm not going to prove that that the base is e to the, what I should be saying here is the product of primes up to something is at least e to the something, roughly. That's what the prime number theorem says. I'm just going to prove 2 to the something with some lower order terms, which you can ignore once the something's reasonably big. And here is this, actually, this is the whole proof. It's going to fit onto one slide here. So this is all the work, and this is, you might be worried when I said easiest theorem, hey, I'm still relying on the prime number theorem, for I said before that if you know the product of primes grows exponentially, that's enough to make q be at most log n to the fifth, but hey, isn't that still a serious theorem? No, it's not. Actually, this proof is due to Erdős, essentially. It's normally stated in a more complicated way to prove Bertrand's postulate that there's always a prime between k and 2k, and then people go through a lot more work to get that. But actually, if you streamline the proof just to try to get the primitive primes as big, then it boils down to just this. This is Erdős's clever idea for how you show that there's lots of primes, that the primitive primes is big. Maybe, again, it's not e to the 2k, where 2k is the bounded on the primes, it's just 2 to the 2k, but hey, that's pretty close, 2 versus 2.7. This is getting towards the prime number thing. All right, what is the statement? It's that if you take all the primes less than or equal to 2k, think of k being log n to the fifth, then the product of those primes is at least 2 to the 2k divided by 2k plus 1, and also divided by the square root of 2k power of 2k. And this whole thing is exponential in k. If k is really big, if k is a million, say, then 2 to the 2 million versus the square root is only like 1,000. So 2 to the million divided by 2 to the 1,000, or maybe it's 2k to the 1,000. So it's a little bit off from 2 to the 2k, but not much. Certainly this converges in logarithm. If you take the logarithm of this divided by the log of k, then that converges to some constant, and that's good enough for the primality proof. Okay, so how do you prove this theorem? Well, the whole point of the proof is look at the factorization of 2k choose k. This is a binomial coefficient. And those of you who have laptops and a program like GP, just try typing in factor binomial 200, 100, for example. And you'll see that actually the primes show up in a surprisingly regular pattern, as the powers of primes in 2k choose k is very, very easy. If a prime is bigger than 2k, then okay, it's obvious that it shows up not at all. It's orts of p, that's a number of powers of p, in this binomial coefficient 2k choose k. And if p is bigger than 2k, then wait a minute, 2k choose k divides 2k factorial, which has only, that's a product 1 through 2k. There's no primes bigger than 2k. No numbers bigger than 2k in there getting multiplied together. So if p is bigger than 2k, it doesn't show up in here. If p is in a huge range, most p's, there's some little annoying technical exceptions which account for the square root, but basically every prime p shows up once, at most once, inside this 2k choose k. For instance, easy case, if p is between k and 2k, then, say it's bigger than k and less than 2k, then how often does it divide 2k choose k? Well, how often does it divide 2k factorial? It divides it once. If p is between k and 2k, then when you take 2k factorial, you've got one copy of p in there. And what about the divided by k factorial a couple times? Well, there's no p's in there if p is bigger than k. So if p is between k and 2k, it divides this exactly once. That's a pretty broad range of p's where actually the inequalities are exactly right. And if p is between, say, 2k over 3 and k, 2/3 of k and 1k, actually then the inequality is too pessimistic, then p doesn't divide this at all. And that's another simple analysis for how often does p divide 2k factorial. If it's bigger than 2k over 3, but less than k, then there's a couple of p's in 2k factorial. And what about k factorial? Well, it shows up once in k factorial, so if you divide by k factorial a couple times, then it disappears entirely. And similarly, for every range of p, you can easily write down the formula for how many times does p divide 2k factorial, and subtract off twice how often does p divide k factorial, and you get for the whole range of p's, the formula looks like the number of times p divides k factorial is the floor of k over p plus the floor of k over p squared, that square accounting for the square root here, plus et cetera, and then easily play with that to get this less than or equal to 1. And then if p is really small, then you have more terms in that sum, and you have to just say, well, okay, there's maybe a pretty big power of p inside this binomial coefficient. This part looks most complicated, but that's the that's the nastiest part of the proof. It's kind of the small part. Just if p is really small, then it gets a little bit harder to analyze how many powers of p there are in this binomial coefficient. Because if p is smaller than this, then maybe there's a p squared dividing 2k factorial and k factorial. Anyway, this analysis, it's a very standard thing. Some of you might have seen it already in number theory courses. How many times does p divide a factorial or a binomial coefficient? You can easily write down general rules like, well, if you have 2k choose k, or in general n choose I, then the number of powers of p in there is the number of carries if you add I to j. J minus I to I. If you have I plus j choose I, then the number of powers of p in there is the number of carries in adding I to j in base p. And that immediately implies this, and almost immediately implies that, and so on. Okay, so these are standard calculations, and once you've done that, then the rest of the inequalities are very easy. First inequality here, well, 2k choose k, that's the biggest binomial coefficient. in a bunch of binomial coefficients, all the 2k choose, 0, 1, 2, 3, up through 2k, there's 2k plus 1 of those binomial coefficients that add up to 2 to the 2k. So the biggest one has to be at least 1 over 2k plus 1 of all of them. 2k choose k is at least 2 to the 2k over 2k plus 1. So I'm relying on the sum of the binomial coefficients is 2 to the 2k, and 2k choose k is the biggest one. Both of those easy to prove. And then 2k choose k is less than or equal to, let's see, let me translate these powers of p into an inequality for the whole thing. If you multiply over all the p's, then 2k choose k has at most, for each p in this range, at most one copy of p. And then for p's being less than square root of 2k, there's at most whatever p is to the power of that log, which ends up being at most 2k. And then all the other p's don't show up at all. So here, it's not just 2k choose k is less than or equal to that. It's a divisor of this. So it's certainly less than or equal to. And then I just crudely said, well, 2k to the power of this number of primes less than or equal to 2k, there's at most square root of 2k primes, so just take 2k to that power. And in the first product, I made that bigger by going all the way down to 1. And again, this is a divisibility. It's not just a less than or equal to. When I said divisibility here, that 2k, what I mean is p to the power of the log of 2k over log p, and then that's less than or equal to 2k. So there's a final inequality, which is exactly the same as what I wrote up there. That's all the analytic number theory you need for the AKS theorem with all the simplifications people have thrown into it. This is a complete proof that primes is in p, that you can detect primes is in capital P, the set of binary representations of prime numbers can be recognized in deterministic polynomial time. Thanks for your attention. Questions? Yeah?
So the whole part of this test is between X minus A and bottleneck, right?
Certainly, yeah. The bottleneck question was the crux of the test is doing X minus A to the nth power. That's the bottleneck. That's what takes the most time. Although for the logic part of it, there's all sorts of things. Yeah.
But when n is composite, when do you generally expect that x minus a to not be equal to x to the n?
Ooh.
When you actually run this test for large n,
it is awfully difficult to come up with a number n where x minus 1 to the n is x to the n minus 1 modulo, for example, x cubed minus 1. Maybe n equals 3. But I mean, aside from trivial cases, if you take even a single cube, it doesn't have to be really big, and you ask for x minus 1 to the n to be congruent to x to the n minus 1 modulo that cube, it's really hard to come up with that. You've heard already, I believe, about...
So most fail on the first test.
Well, yeah, most fail on the first test. And you've heard about, suppose you tried q equals 1. Suppose, maybe that's a little too simple if I took x minus 1, but suppose q is 1, and you take x minus 2. So computing x minus 2 to the n mod x minus 1, and comparing that to x minus 2, that's the same, a little too simple. Let me make that x minus 3. Then if you, computing mod x minus 1 just means substitute x equals 1. So what I just said there is taking the nth power of minus 2 modulo n and seeing if you get minus 2. And that already, just for q equals 1 and a single a equals 3, that's the same as the usual 2 to the n minus 2 test, or minus 2 to the n minus 2, that weeds out almost all composites immediately. And then when q gets bigger, if you're computing mod x squared minus 1, suddenly you're doing a quadratic test, which already it's somewhat independent of the original test, and it's awfully hard to find a number that passes both an x minus 1 test and an x plus 1 or an x squared minus 1 test. And if you go up to cubic, it becomes even more difficult. Now, and for any particular number there, like if you took a fixed cube, it is conjectured that for each fixed cube, there exist infinitely many n's. And there's even asymptotics for what we think. It's kind of like Carmichael numbers. We think that there's lots of n's that satisfy this. But it's extremely difficult to find them. For the smallest case, 2 to the n being congruent to 2, it's possible. And for that, you just say, OK, and it's 341 does the trick. But as you make bigger and bigger conditions, increase q just a little bit, it becomes extremely difficult to compute an n that's not prime for which those equations hold. However, the best we have for proofs is if you take a much larger q and a bunch of x minus a's, and then you can put those together to do this combinatorial construction of a bunch of products, which magically implies that n is prime. So we don't have proofs of anything.
If you start with a deposit, you generally know it's a deposit very quickly.
That's right. You can easily convince yourself of a deposit. Yeah, the effort here is for justifying the answer. I think you heard last week about strong probable prime tests, and I see a couple of nods there. So a strong probable prime test, if you're, and in my next talk, I'll try to talk about the state of the art and what we have that's faster than proving primality and alternatives to proofs and fit it into a big picture. But certainly what you've heard about already is that if you do strong probable prime tests and you feed them a composite number, then every one of those tests is going to flunk the composite number with probability at least, say, 3/4. And then if you do that 100 times, then you're basically guaranteed for any composite number to say, yes, it's composite, here's a proof that it's composite. Now, in light of that, if you feed it a prime number and you run the test 100 times and it keeps failing to prove it's composite, then you think, okay, that's pretty convincing, and surely it's prime. Either it's prime or we got really, really, really unlucky. But that's not up to the mathematical standards of a rigorous proof. It might be that, okay, you did get really, really unlucky, and this type of proof is, there's no possibility of non-luck, there's no randomness here, there's every step is thoroughly justified from the previous one. And if you want that standard of convincing somebody that a number is prime, then you can't use a strong probable prime test. For practical purposes, depending what you're doing, maybe you want a proof to convince some banker that, yes, there's no possibility of error here. Your financial institution can invest in the following prime number. As a practical matter, people don't do these proofs. I'll try to say next time what the fastest primality proofs we have are and compare that to the fastest ways we have to convince somebody to fail to prove compositeness. That's pretty convincing that a number is prime, and we'll see how much of a ratio there is there. Certainly we have much better than 6. I'll try to tell you about the exponents there. You can see how the scaling of primality proofs is compared to failing to come up with a compositeness proof, which is another way to convince somebody that a number is prime. Again, if you're looking at an auditor and trying to tell them, yes, we know this number is prime, then it's convenient to have these absolute proofs rather than the possibility of getting unlucky. But okay, in cryptography, we're generally happy with not doing primality proofs. All right, other questions about this primality proof? All right, thanks again for your attention.